This is chapter 15 of Men of the Covenant by Alexander Smylie. A field preacher. It is a foolish but not an uncommon mistake, the notion that the men of the covenant were all of lowly and plebeian birth. The dedicated army, with its banner of blue and its passion for the kingly rights of Christ, drew most of its recruits from the peasants and shepherds of the countryside and from the traders in the towns. And these homely warriors, as they fought their spiritual battle, showed as fine a courage as any paladins of the court. But there were men and women of higher degree, proud to associate themselves with the cause of Presbytery. Some of the wise and mighty were called, and with prominent promptitude they answered the call. John Blackadder is one of the gentlefolks who rallied to the defence of the kirk. He was the scion of a famous family. The original home of his kindred was in Berwickshire, and among his forebears there were figures valorous and picturesque. In the middle of the 15th century, the Black Band of the Black Adders, father and seven sons, each of them swarthy in complexion, had time and again beaten back the invading English. Weakness was not in their word, weariness not on their brow. They did not restrict their exploits to Scottish soil, and to the defence of their own castles and crofts. Like Job's warhorse, they scented the battle from afar. Those were the days when the southern kingdom was rent by the contentions of York and Lancaster, and Cuthbert Blackadder, with his dauntless seven, marshalled themselves under the standard of the Red Rose. But if they reaped renown in England, they found duel and death waiting for them too. On Bosworth Field, the veteran and three of his black band were slain, and the survivors came home grieved for the flowers of the forest that blossomed at their side no longer. Yet because they had been so brave, James of Scotland granted them in their hearts the privilege of carrying on their shields the two roses, red and white. Their crest was a right hand holding aloft a broadsword, and their motto ran, "Courage helps fortune." In later years, a sea of troubles overtook the Blackadders. The homes of Wedderburn were at feud with them, and in the strife they fared badly. Ultimately, the Berwickshire branch lost its commanding position, and the honour of maintaining the household name passed to younger sons who had come by marriage into the estate of Tully Allen in Perthshire. Our field preacher is of the Tully Allen stock. He was born in December of 1615, but although he has some claim to distinction, as his memoirs say, because he was a representative of an ancient and once opulent house, his was to be a different and a holier frame. He was, his student son Robert wrote in 1686, when his father's race was run, a good soldier and servant of Jesus Christ, who esteemed his master's reproaches greater riches than all the treasures and pleasures of this Egyptian world. Old Cuthbert Blackadder, trusty as a tree, was not more unbending than John Blackadder, the minister of the Covenant. After being trained under his uncle, William Strang, principal of Glasgow College, where Sion became the rival of Athens and Rome, he went up and down the country preaching the gospel. One is at some loss to understand why he was so long in finding a charge of his own. Not until 1653, when he was a man of 37, was he ordained over the parish of Traquair in the Presbytery of Dumfries. But it was well that he came to his work in the maturity of his powers. His parish was sadly backward. The people were ignorant, some of them living in scandalous sin, many inclined to popish beliefs and ways. He had an uphill road to travel, but in due time he gained the topmost ridge. First he reformed the eldership and then gradually changed the face of the congregation and of the whole neighbourhood. Twice every Sabbath he preached, and once too every Tuesday, except in the throng of seedtime and harvest. In his sermons he explored and explained the whole territory of saving knowledge. All who could read he exhorted to provide themselves with Bibles, and those who could not were enjoined to seek out some family where, round the altar set up on the hearth, they might listen to God's word. In spring and again in autumn he catechised his parishioners. It was a duty performed in no perfunctory style. He took inspection into their behaviour. he had many a searching question. Did they remember secret prayer? Morning and evening did they kneel together at the throne of their father and their king? Was the Sabbath a delight? Did the parents instruct their children in the truth? If they had servants, did they curb profanity in any whom they found to miscarry? Somewhat rigid the old-time oversight of the flock may seem, but it bore a salutary harvest. Traquair and its minister and session may have been one of the places which Bishop Burnet had in his thoughts when he penned his tribute to the Presbyterians of the Commonwealth. They had brought the people to such a degree of knowledge that cottagers and servants would have prayed extempore had they had a comprehension of matters of religion greater than I have seen among people of that sort anywhere. For 9 years, John Blackadder pursued his calling till the advent of Middleton's Glasgow Act, and he was among the faithful who could not bow the knee. On a November Sabbath, with the noise of sobbing heard through the church, he took his farewell. The dragoons from Dumfries were there, but meantime they did not meddle him. During the week which succeeded, from sunrise until far in the night, he moved from family to family, praying in each farm, kitchen and cottage, and commending to God every separate soul. Then on Saturday he rode away to Glen Cairn to seek a place of safety beyond the bounds of his presbytery. His wife and children were to follow, but no sooner was he gone than the soldiers returned. They attacked the manse and behaved with cruelty and insolence to its defenceless inmates. One of the boys never forgot the wild Blue Blenders, nor the adventures of the critical day. Bag and bag catch, baggage. We who were the children were put into cadgers' creels, where one of us cried out, coming through the brigand of Dumfries, "I'm banished, I'm banished." The Traquair ministry had an ending both sudden and sore, so it sounds like the children were locked up in baskets. John Blackadder did not commence at once to preach in the fields. If he was fervent of soul, he was cautious in action. The epitaph on his tomb celebrates the balance and equipoise of his nature. Zeal warmed his breast and reason cooled his head. As long as might be, he refrained from giving provocation to the authorities. And so there were some who held conventicles before he went out to hillside and glen. There was Gabriel Sempill, for instance, also the son of a noble house, and there was John Welsh of Iron Grey. We must tarry over Welsh's name. He is one of the kings of the time. His father and his grandfather were ministers before him. He was himself the great-grandson of John Knox, and he inherited the godliness and the manliness of his progenitors. He had been a co-presbyter with Blackadder, and like him, had been driven out by Middleton's folly. In his case, too, the importunity and the affection of the parish pursued the preacher, and would scarcely let him go. His horse waited for him at the Water of Cludden, and he had to dash into the stream and gallop rapidly away. Even though through the wintry little river men and women followed him, not turning back while he remained in sight, it makes us think of a similar scene in a different place and time. When Sir Henry Lawrence left the government of the Punjab in 1853, grief was written on every face. Old and young, rich and poor, soldiers and civilians, Englishmen and natives, felt that they were losing a friend. Strong men, like Sir Herbert Edwards, might be seen weeping like children. A cavalcade of Sikh chiefs accompanied the departing ruler, some for 5, others for 10, others for 20 or 25 miles. It was a long, living funeral procession from Lahore nearly to Amritsar. None knew Sir Henry Lawrence but to love him, and it was the same with John Welsh. In one respect, the members of his flock were happier than their neighbours at Traquair. He continued their pastor in a sense, although he was not allowed to speak within the church walls. In defence of every hostile edict, he returned again and again. Sometimes he was back in valley or in wood or in meadow, once a week for successive months. There was not a child whom he did not baptise. Often the familiar voice was heard proclaiming the familiar message. But now it might be said that he had taken all the lowlands for his diocese. Summer and winter he was engaged in field preachings. The boldest undertaker, the most audacious lionheart that ever I knew a minister in Christ Church. It is James Kirkton's tribute. For, notwithstanding the threatenings of the state, the great price of £500 set on his head, the spite of bishops, the diligence of all bloodhounds, he maintained his difficult task of preaching upon the mountains of Scotland, many times to many thousands for near 20 years. I have known, his biographer adds, Mr. Welsh ride 3 days and two nights without sleep and preach upon a mountain at midnight on one of the nights. He had for some time a dwelling house near Tweedside, and when Tweed was strongly frozen, he preached in the middle of the river that either he might shun the offence of both nations, the Tweed separating from Scotland from England at that time, or that two kingdoms might dispute his crime. We catch glimpses of him, too, with a bodyguard of 12 gentlemen in scarlet, whom he had bound to himself in a loyalty as devoted as that of the Gittites to David. Go and read upon Ittai, the Gittite. Journeying hither and thither on horseback through the green trees of the woods and among the fields of the Lothians and Fife, there were the vivid colours of romance and the charm of mystery and the poetry of peril about a minister's life 250 years ago. John Welsh's word was with power. Once, when he was chased unrelentingly, he hardly knew where to flee. But relying on Scottish hospitality, he knocked at the door of a landlord bitterly opposed to the field preachers, and to himself in particular, although he had never actually set eyes on him. The stranger, being unrecognised, was received with kindness. In the evening's talk, reference was made to Welsh, and the host complained of the difficulty of capturing him. "I am sent," the visitor said, "to apprehend rebels. I know where he is to preach tomorrow. I will put his hand into yours." Overjoyed, the gentleman agreed to accompany his informant next morning. When they arrived at the appointed spot, the congregation had assembled. The people made way for the minister whom they trusted and for his comrade. Welsh desired his entertainer to sit down on the solitary chair which had been provided for himself, and to his companion's utter bewilderment, took his own stand beside it, and rang out the story of sin and salvation. The Spirit of God was there, and the landlord was heartbroken. When at the close, Welsh, fulfilling his promise, gave him his hand that he might do with him whatever he wished, he said, "You told me that you were sent to apprehend rebels. I, a rebellious sinner, have been apprehended this day." But let us return to John Blackadder. He continued in his Galloway retreat until, by a fresh onslaught of persecution, he was driven forth into the wider sphere of work. Early in the winter of 1666, Sir James Turner and a party of soldiers came looking for him. Happily, he was himself absent in Edinburgh, but again wife and bairns suffered at the hands of the rascally Muffet ruffians. And again we have the best account of what happened in the artless words of one of the children. He tells how, about 2 o'clock in the morning, the dragoons surrounded the house, cursing on the Whigs to open the door. How, when they got in, they went to stools and chairs and demolished them with their swords to make a fire. How they stabbed through beds and bedclothes to find the man for whom they were in search. How they threw down his books from the press upon the floor, and caused poor me hold the candle till they had examined them, and all they thought Whiggish, as they termed it. And brave judges they were. They put into a great horse creel, and took away. How they climbed up to the hen balks, where the cocks and hens were, and as they came to one, threw about its neck, and down to the floor, wit with it, and so on, till they had destroyed them all. Glad at heart the boy of 10 was, when he managed to elude his tormentors. Naked to the shirt, he ran through the darkness to the brigend of Menaheavy, and there, discovering that the inhabitants were still in slumber, he climbed into to the uppermost step of the village cross and fell fast asleep. Between 5 and 6, a door opens, and an old woman comes out, and seeing a white thing upon the cross, comes near it, and when she found it was a little boy, cries out, "Save us, what art thou?" With that I awaked and answered her, "I'm Mr. Blackadder's son." "Ah, my poor bairn, what brought thee here?" I answers. "There's a handful of fearful men with red coats has burnt all our house." "Oh, poor thing," says she, "come in and lie down in my warm bed." And the child did as he was bidden, and it was the sweetest bed ever he met with. It was this rude visitation of Turner's soldiery which compelled Blackadder into his larger bishopric. He tried no longer to conciliate masters who were so barbarous. He became one of the chiefs in the great conventicles of the time. John Welsh and Gabriel Semple and he were the three first worthies. He was another indefatigable Paul, says his soldier son, Colonel Blackadder. travelling through most parts of Scotland, except among the Highlanders, whose case he sadly regretted. For I heard him many a time say he would be content to go 1,000 miles on foot to have had the Highland language, Gaelica. The intolerable craving to save shivered through him like a trumpet call. We must think of him in the years which ensued, having his headquarters in Edinburgh, but hastening everywhere on his divine errands. Through trustworthy channels, messages were sent to him to inform him that a crowd of those who were hungering for the bread of life proposed to meet at this selected spot or that other, and then he and his good horse would sally forth in time for the gathering. Thus in September 1668 there came a man from Dunlop Parish to New Milns, where the preacher was lodged for a few days. So he rode about 9 miles of very bad road and came to the place very weary, expecting to have gotten rest that night. But the people had trysted the parents with their children, so he behoved to address himself to the work and went about 11 o'clock at night to a great meeting, where he preached an hour and a half, and thereafter baptized 42 children, dividing them the one half at one time, the other afterwards, because they could not get all conveniently stood together. And after this was done, it was hard on break of day. In January 1669, he is at Fenwick, with its memories of William Guthrie, where there has been no Presbyterian preaching since the defeat at Pentland. But by his two abundant toils, he has made himself ill, and for 16 weeks he is imprisoned in the sick room. No sooner is health restored than the work is resumed. At Bowness he establishes a new congregation. At Paisley he has a multitude of 1,200 listeners. At Aburnside in the moors near Livingston, where his text was the tender word, "The Son of Man is come to seek and to save that which is lost," an assemblage from many parishes hangs on his lips. The people seem to smell him out in spite of his caution. Like his king and friend, he could not be hid. Living so much in the sun and the keen air, facing the weather in heat and cold, he discovered that his sight, employed hitherto in quiet reading and study, was being much impaired. But he did not grieve over the loss. The eye in the heart that lies grew clearer with every year. Some of the conventicles in which he played a principal part were very noteworthy. There was, for example, the gathering on the hill of Beath, near Dunfermline, in the midsummer of 1670. It was a district where ignorance and profanity were prevalent, and, for the more solemnity and upstirring of a barbarous people. The preacher took a colleague with him. John Dixon was his companion. Having crossed the Firth of Forth on Saturday night, and having slept for a few hours at Inverkeithing without putting off his clothes, Blackadder rose early and went in quest of the meeting place. Already the congregation was there, for worship was to begin at 8 o'clock. First, Dixon lectured standing in the mouth of the tent and addressing the crowd which thronged to the Brayside. Then John Blackadder preached from that favourite text of covenanting ministers, "He must reign till he hath put all enemies under his feet." It was 7 o'clock ere he finished, and there was to be an interval of rest before the work of the afternoon. But there had been signs that those present were not all friends, and now, when the preacher started anew, things looked threatening. A lieutenant of militia dismounted from his horse and came in among the people, massed on the minister's left hand. Fortunately, Blackadder's second discourse had the wooing note in it. It was composing and gaining, holding forth the great design of the gospel to invite and make welcome all sorts of sinners without exception. The lieutenant could find no fault. He stood a space and heard peaceably, yet there might easily have been a conflagration. For when the officer lifted his foot to the stirrup to ride off, some tried to prevent him, and he thrust them back, and there was prospect of tumult, and perhaps of bloodshed. But Blackadder saw it, and interrupted his sermon, and went to the soldier's assistance. Calming the angry men with wise words, he spoke to the officer, "Let me see, sir, who will offer to wrong you. They shall as soon wrong myself, for we came here to do violence to no man, but to proclaim the gospel of peace. If you be pleased to stay, you shall be as welcome as any, but if you will not, you are free to go." The lieutenant escaped scatheless, and the services proceeded until late in the day. Very tired the minister was before he reached his Edinburgh home next morning. At Queen's Ferry he could not induce a boatman to row him over the Firth, and he had perforce to ride the long way round by Stirling. That's a very long way. He was 7 hours in the saddle after all the mental and spiritual exertion of that memorable Sabbath. Were not his campaigns as exacting as those of his fighting ancestors? The Dunfermline Conventicle is worth remembering for another reason. It was one of the first to which many of the worshippers came armed. In 1670, the blink was almost over, and Lauderdale's administration was again becoming pitiless. So the Covenanters did what they had not done before, but what they repeated frequently in subsequent months. They carried sword and pistol with them to the hill where they sang their psalms, and presented their prayers and hearkened to the evangel of Christ. We cannot blame them for a precaution to which they were forced in self-defence, even if this conjunction of the weapons of a carnal warfare with the melodies of the everlasting chime seems in some degree incongruous. In desperate times, men are guiltless who resort to desperate measures. But more remarkable and more beautiful than the ordinary conventicle was a communion in the fields. John Blackadder will describe to us one of these which he, in company with Mr. Welsh and Mr. Riddle, superintended and enjoyed at East Nisbet in the border country. After relating what means were adopted to shield from interruption and alarm those whose rendezvous, however fit it might be, was by the lions, dens, and the mountains of leopards, he goes on with his tale. We entered on the administration of the holy ordinance, committing it and ourselves to the invisible protection of the Lord of Hosts, in whose name we were met together. The place where we were convened was every way commodious, and seemed to have been formed on purpose. It was a green and pleasant haw fast by the waterside. On either hand, there was a spacious brae in form of a half-round, covered with delightful pasture, and rising with a gentle slope to a goodly height. Above us was the clear blue sky, for it was a sweet and calm Sabbath morning, promising to be indeed one of the days of the Son of Man. The communion tables were spread on the green by the water, and around them the people had arranged themselves in decent order. But the far greater multitude sat on the brae face, which was crowded from top to bottom. Each day the congregations, dismissing the ministers with their guards, and as many of the people as could, retired to their quarters in three several country towns, where they might be provided with necessities. The horsemen drew up in a body, and then marched in goodly array behind the people until all were safely lodged. In the morning, when they returned, the horsemen accompanied them. All the three parties met a mile from the spot, and marched in a full body to the consecrated ground. The congregation being fairly settled, the guardsmen took their stations as formerly. They secured the peace and quiet of the audience, for, from Saturday morning, when the work began, until Monday afternoon, we suffered not the least affront or molestation from enemies, which appeared wonderful. The whole was closed in as orderly a way as it had been in the time of Scotland's brightest noon. And, truly, the spectacle of so many grave, composed and devout faces must have struck the adversaries with awe, and been more formidable than any outward ability of fierce looks and warlike array. We desired not the countenance of earthly kings. There was a spiritual and divine majesty shining on the work. Amidst the lonely mountains, we remembered the words of our Lord, that true worship was not peculiar to Jerusalem or Samaria, that the beauty of holiness consisted not in material temples. We remembered the ark of the Israelites, which had sojourned for years in the desert, with no dwelling but the tabernacle of the plain. We thought of Abraham and the ancient patriarchs, who laid their victims on the rocks for an altar and burned sweet incense under the shade of the green tree. The ordinance of the Last Supper was signally backed with refreshing influence from above. Few such days were seen in the desolate church of Scotland, and few will ever witness the like. There was a rich effusion of the Spirit shed abroad in many. Their souls breathed in a diviner element and burned upwards as with the fire of a pure and holy devotion. The ministers were visibly assisted to speak home to the conscience of the hearers. They who witnessed declared they carried more like ambassadors from the court of heaven than men cast in earthly mould. The tables were served by some gentlemen and persons of the gravest deportment. The communicants entered at one end and retired at the other, a way being kept clear to take their seats again on the hillside. Solemn it was, and edifying to see the composure of all present. And it was pleasant as the night fell to hear their melody swelling in full unison along the hill, the whole congregation joining with one accord. There were two long tables and one short, across the head, with seats on each side. About 100 sat at every table. There were 16 tables in all, so that about 3,200 communicated that day. It is a long quotation, but it portrays a noble scene in noble words. The preacher, who could delineate the solemnity so fittingly, never halted in his missionary journeys for some 15 years, except when illness chained him to his house. He expounded the counsel of God. We meet him and his pony in Fifeshire, in the Lothians, in Lanarkshire, in Carrick and Cunningham, in Annandale, among the hills of Galloway. Once he halts to baptise a poor man's child by the moss side, and a crowd collects, and as they appear to be poor innocents who rarely hear his sort of preaching, he accompanies the ceremony with a short lecture. Once, in his old parish of Traquair, he intends holding the meeting on a knoll amongst the trees, but the day is windy and there is such commotion of leaves and branches that the people cannot hear, and say they go to a green and open expanse near the laird of Dalsgarth's house. Once at Dunscore, it is a time of deep snow, and among the white snow a chair is set for the minister, and the men and women pull bunches of heather and sit hearkening on the moor. There are 100 exhilarating incidents which cluster round the name of John Blackadder. He missed no fruitful chance that came to him, until early on an April morning in 1681 his enemies seized him in Edinburgh and sent him to close his toiling and suffering and rejoicing days in the prison on the Bass Rock. That's a great rock in the middle of the Firth of Forth, and a horrible prison. His fathers fought for the Red Rose and won it for their crest, but surely his own crest was not the Red Rose so much as the White Rose, not indeed of York, but of heaven. We recollect Martin Luther's words, "I took for the symbol of my theology a seal on which I had engraven a cross, with a heart in its centre. The cross is black to indicate the sorrows even unto death, through which the Christian must pass. But the heart preserves its natural colour, for the cross does not extinguish nature, does not kill, but give life. The heart is placed in the midst of a white rose, which signifies the joy, peace and consolation that faith brings. But the rose is white and not red, because it is not the joy and peace of the world, but that of spirits." This was the flower, supernal and undying, which John Blackadder carried on his shield and in his soul. I mean, thank God for such men, and thank God for such boldness and such endurance in preaching the gospel. And one thing we see is that this man was hunted, but at the same time the people were hungry and they came out to see him. Well, I mean, what different days we live in. I have absolute freedom to preach the gospel, but there are so few who want to hear. Yet we must still do what John Blackadder did. We must remain faithful, fervent and constant in preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ.